As Lyndon Johnson said so well, politics is the art of the possible. It is not always possible to win, but if we know what is possible, if we sense the correct timing, if we're aware of a coalition of supporters that can be put together, we can possibly prevail. Figuring out how to win gets us into the realm of political behavior. Perhaps the definition of politics should be simply that it is the art of putting existing possibilities into a winning combination. Many remember John Kennedy with great affection, and in the first 18 months of his presidency, he was much admired and much thought of. He was young, handsome, rich, successful, and had a great sense of humor. But the fact remains that not one major piece of his legislative program passed the U.S. Congress. Following his tragic assassination, Lyndon Johnson became president. In a short period of 2 years, all of the legislation that he proposed was passed. So who was the more powerful of these two presidents? Kennedy, who spoke to the nation's ideals, or Johnson, who spoke the language of Congress? Power and politics are the art of the possible, and getting the possible accomplished is a key concept. Let's talk about what the word politics means. Politics, like the word power, has many negative connotations. Politics is sometimes seen by certain people as putting an individual in some interesting and unique anatomical positions in which they kiss the ring, lick the boot, and do other interesting things we don't respect. I'm not suggesting that politics means one should be a political animal. I'm not suggesting that to gain power, you should suffer a loss of integrity. What I am saying is that in politics, it's important to have a sense of the politic, knowing what is appropriate to the situation and what is doable now. As we consider the political world in which we're operating, for every business has politics. Let's examine some key strategies for gaining and using power. We all operate within both a formal and informal organization world. The formal world of the organization is seen in the organizational chart. It comes in the form of job descriptions. The formalities also include the rules and policies of our companies. But it's naive to think that that is the way organizations really work. There's a second world of the informal political world. And in this informal world, very little, if anything, is written down. It's not only important what you know, it's important who you know. And there are informal political world strategies that must be mastered to win the game. We're going to talk about two of them here. The first rule of the informal world is gain visibility. It's important that you be seen and heard because power depends on the perception of others. If they don't perceive you, if they don't know you're there, it will be impossible for you to have any power with them. And so we must position ourselves so that others know we're there. For example, watch what people do when they return from an outside seminar. Some who return write a 13-page trip report and send out 20 copies because that's what the policy manual, the formal world, calls for. Since no one reads those trip reports, that person's visibility is zero. Others returning from the seminar with more experience might give a modest nod to the policy manual. They write a half-page memo and send out 3 copies. Nobody reads that either. Yet others, truly wise in the ways of the informal world, forget about writing the report altogether. They simply stop in the boss's office and say something like, "You know, boss, I was in Washington last week for a 3-day meeting, and I must say what I heard was disturbing." Boss says, "What are you talking about?" And the subordinate would say, "Well, they were talking about a number of things that they were doing in their marketing and organizational design, and I think that they may be onto something that perhaps we haven't thought about." Now the boss is alarmed and says, "Well, what exactly are you talking about?" And this individual says, "Well, not now, boss, not now. I'd like to go back to my office and put my thinking together and give you a specific proposal so that you can understand better what I think we need to do. If I could perhaps have 15 minutes of your time next Thursday or Friday." And the boss says, "How about this Monday?" This is an individual who in the informal political world has gained visibility with the boss. He stood out that day and not just blended in with the continuous noise of communications. A second way to gain visibility is to ask yourself, what additional work or projects should I be involved in? The reality is that when you do your job day in and day out, people tend to take the maintenance of the job for granted. You don't get much press for simply doing your job well. It's the new stuff you do that tends to get the respect and the spotlight. So the question, what have you done for us lately, is in fact a legitimate question. Many managers practice what I call lava flow expansion. Like Mount St. Helens, they spread out as they erupt into new areas of power. They look around for projects to acquire. They ask themselves, what additional responsibility can I envelop and surround? Right now, within your reach, there may be two or three hot potatoes that nobody's handling. You may want to reach out and grab onto one of those and do something with it. As you consider entering new areas to increase your visibility, you must be very selective. Pick very carefully the work arenas in which you want to do something. Don't go after projects that will put you into the invisible corners. Ask yourself, what's my board concerned about? What's my boss concerned about? And then find a piece of work related to those concerns. As you get additional responsibility, you may run into conflict. As you expand your territory, you may encroach on another executive's turf. Just as animals have territorial imperatives, so too do managers and executives. Don't be afraid of those, and don't shrink back from the rub points. Move forward with confidence, knowing that this is work that needs to be done. But at the same time, be prepared to defend your territorial limits. Be prepared to negotiate and bargain over territory. There may be a discussion between you and another executive about who should do a piece of work. Perhaps you'll maintain your position and say, I should have responsibility for this. On the other hand, you may choose a different stance and say, boss, if Mary wants this area of responsibility, it's fine with me. I think both of us saw the need to do this, and I don't think there's any reason why it has to be done in my area. And when you leave the boss's office, where both of you have made a favorable impression, turn to Mary and offer to buy a cup of coffee. This is another powerful person, and you need to establish a relationship with her. As you climb the ladder, you discover quickly that all managerial titles and the holders of those titles are not equal. Mary is power-oriented. Mary is going somewhere in her career, and it's important now to start to establish an informal connection with her. Another simple way to increase visibility is to channel and control as much of the information flow within your organization as you can. Now, if you read a time management book, it would say to you, get off of distribution lists, get out of the paper flow, because it's taking a lot of your time. And while that's a good time management suggestion, it ignores the importance of such things in power management. For you to be visible, it's important that people in the organization route to you as much of the significant paper as possible. It's important that you receive whatever value exists in the documents. One time out of 100, there's going to be a crucial issue. And because your name is on the distribution list, you have a legitimate right to speak out on that issue. A second benefit that accrues from being in the information flow is that people in the organization, as they're dictating, are going to think, I wonder who I should copy on this. Someone will suggest to them that you ought to be copied, and they'll say, why? They'll respond, well, I don't know, but everybody sends them stuff. And the perception then is that you have become a reference point that must be covered on these communications. That perception favors you in the informal world. One last idea for high visibility is that you be very active in the committee structures of your organization. Some people want to be the chairman of committees, and certainly having position power on those committees is worth considering. But I'd like you to consider, however, other power positions on the committee. If you have three men and three women on a committee, odds are it's going to be one of the women who will be asked to be secretary, a piece of sexist behavior. I'd like you to think about what happens when that kind of thinking enters the political arena. What it means is that the males who have jokingly engineered this have just given away the power slot which decides what we are going to talk about on the agenda and the order in which these things will be discussed. If you're a male, perhaps next time you'll volunteer to be secretary. And for powerful image, insist that those meetings be run correctly. Start on time, stop on time, pace it in between, have an agenda. A second major factor to consider in the informal political world is executive sponsorship. Rather than trying to fuel your own dreams and project proposals with only your own power, it can be valuable to be sponsored by someone else. Sponsors can have additional, if not more, power, and together your clout is enhanced. Have you identified the VIPs and the rising stars within your organization? The VIPs often have long titles and lots of position power, but not everybody who's a vice president is really a VIP. There may be 7 vice presidents in a company, and only 2 have any real power. There may be 17 middle managers in a division, and only 3 have the power. So who are the VIPs? There are certain locus points where important decisions are being made. What are the issues in your own organization right now that seem to be occupying the power people? Perhaps it's cost containment. Maybe the discussion is focused on marketing. There may be a quality control problem. What are the major issues that have gained the ear and attention of these people? Get involved in precisely these areas. Ask yourself, what's worrying them? What are they going for? Where are they expending energy? And then ask, how can I become involved directly with those decisions? How can I contribute in some way? It's in the heat of such battles where certain political bonds between managers are formed. It's important that you be on the same field of battle. It's the only place where battlefield commissions get awarded. A lot has been written in recent years about employee loyalty. Loyalty seems to be a dead word and a lost value among many American workers today. But loyalty is not a dead concept or a meaningless word among management. Loyalty links power people. The French phrase, noblesse oblige, stands for the obligations of nobility. The concept among the ancient ruling class was that an individual who served as an executive had certain obligations. Consider the story of Richard the Lionheart. He went to the Holy Lands on the Crusades. We remember well the story of wicked King John and others who prevailed at home while King Richard was away. Richard was leading the army, an army he had solicited by going to the nobles or middle managers. The nobles supported this power person with their money, their arms, and their presence on the field of battle. When the battle was over, when the victories were won, and all had returned home, the king gathered around him those who had been faithful. It was payoff time. To those who had been loyal, he gave lands and castles and money and titles and position. And where did the king get these lands and titles and monies? He got it from those who had not supported him at the moment and place where the key issues were being decided. In today's business world, nothing's changed. If you want additional organization power, lands, monies, and titles, the name of the game is support the king. Sometimes we see managers failing to support executive decisions when they've been made. It's in fashion, I suppose, to sit around the cafeteria table second-guessing the decisions from the executive suite. Sometimes, in fact, the decisions may not be entirely correct, but it's doubtful that criticizing them is going to be seen as contribution. I learned this lesson in a very vivid situation early in my career. I had the opportunity to make a major presentation to a vice president of manufacturing, whom I'll call Jake. This executive supervised 1,700 people. His right-hand man was the director of production, a man by the name of Stu. As I finished making my presentation to the best of my ability with as many facts as I could muster and as much logic as I could marshal, the vice president of manufacturing turned to his director and said, "Stu, you heard what Clay has said. Do you have anything to say in rebuttal?" Stu immediately went through my presentation point for point as though he were running a lawnmower over it. He disputed my facts. He shredded my logic. Inwardly, I was angry. I just didn't understand what this vice president was doing. What he was doing, of course, was fostering a debate before he made his decision. And after Stu had finished doing a hatchet job on my presentation, Jake turned to me and said, "Clay, you've heard Stu's objections. What would you say in rejoinder?" Again, I came back with what I thought were my 3 or 4 best arguments, and Stu again was invited to respond to those, which he did, this time firing up his weed whacker. When we were done, Jake sat back in his chair and said, "Well, I think I adequately heard both sides of the argument. Stu, all things considered, I'm going to go ahead with Clay's proposal, and I want you to do whatever's necessary to make it happen." And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, fat chance. Stu is emotionally geared up to run a spear through this thing. There's no way in the world I'm going to get the support I need to make this thing work. It's sandbagged from the beginning. But I was startled and later amazed to find that Stu was as good as his word when he said, "Fine, Jake. I'll get with Clay immediately following this meeting. We'll get things ironed out so we can get started on Monday." What I saw before me was the loyalty that's essential when decisions are reached, as well as the equal demonstration of loyalty that's shown when a contrary point of view is first presented. It's my belief, as I have watched the career lives of successful men and women in management, that you owe both sides of that equation to the executives you're supporting. Certainly no discussion of power would be complete without examining the role of power as it's exhibited by others. I'm struck by how many book titles purport to tell you how to be an effective leader and how to be a success in management. The popular picture of management success that's presented assumes that you're going to magically move into management and that you're going to be the order giver and the great person with vision and all the other positive words. I'm equally struck by the fact that there's no literature available whatsoever on how to be an effective follower or an effective staff person or a number 2 or a number 29 in the hierarchy. Nobody seems to want to write those kinds of books. Yet all of us have a staff or subordinate role that we have to play in the organization world and in the world of power. Being an effective subordinate can be key to greater power in the future. Everybody has a boss. Even the president of your corporation works for a board. Board members, in turn, can be replaced by shareholders. Everybody has to master some authority relationships. I don't think that means that we have to think of ourselves as peons, but I think we have to consider how to best relate to those significant others who hold power over us. Based on my own research and in numerous discussions with executives, being able to carry out the staff role effectively and to provide executive support have been important considerations when a candidate was being considered for promotion. In analyzing the factors most often mentioned by executives, three primary areas emerge in which we must successfully carry out the subordinate role if we want greater executive responsibility. We may not agree with these executive viewpoints, but it's essential to understand these performance areas. They represent a checklist against which you can monitor your own performance and promotion prospects. The first of these areas for self-examination I call building customer and client relationships. Many managers view other managers and departments simply as bodies on the payroll. But executives I've talked with said they were most impressed by those managers who treated other managers and departments as customers. They seem to go at the relationship and the work in a totally different way. Who are your customers? Or if you don't like the word customers, who are your clients? What is the nature of the relationships that you've established with these people? Effective subordinates tend to proceed on the assumption that they are there to serve customer and client needs. Remember, we're using the word customer to define anyone you serve, whether that means another department or an actual paying consumer. Allow me to provide some specifics to underline that statement. Executives tell me repeatedly that their effective staff people are preoccupied with creating saleable, quality products, services, and outcomes. The work they do is of high quality because that's what the customer buys and really wants. And it also is something that's extremely easy to sell. Many of the items you may be pursuing right now on your work agenda may be needed by the organization, but they may not be saleable at this time. So ask yourself, am I producing good stuff? And am I then selling it? Everything in this world has to be sold. To have power in the organization means that you have the ability to sell the product of your unit to the customer. Many times you have to rely on members of your staff to represent you. Whether your customer is an outside individual who literally buys your product or service, or another department manager, or your boss, you often must rely on one of your staff to represent you. Do they have that same dedication to the customer that you have? Are the people representing you acting with an internal customer orientation, or are they simply ordering other departments about? Do these people represent you as someone who wants to help? Are they taking time to help? Top executives say they like it when the manager or his or her agent seems to be operating in that fashion. Another suggestion from these executives is that for effective staff performance, don't compromise standards. Don't overlook problems. Now, the reality is that when you insist to a customer that they're doing something incorrectly, something against policy or the financial interest of the firm, you're liable to generate some conflict. And if you're asked not to enforce a standard, either through intimidation or an open request, you must make a choice. Executives report that while non-enforcement may smooth out the relationship temporarily, in the long run, the organization or customer will be more exposed to danger or difficulty than they were before. So said the executives, effective staff people were those who didn't compromise standards. A final suggestion in terms of developing customer and client relations is to recognize the fact that within any organization, there are really different businesses and different needs of customers within that organization. I worked once with a personnel executive who had to pull back some of his young chargers because they were out there trying to implement personnel policy on an absolute uniformity basis, not realizing that certain divisions within that organization could afford and needed the full range of personnel policy, while others that were new and struggling would simply be weighted down with unnecessary requirements. This executive realized what Emerson said, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." And so, although you're trying to sell the whole package, you must realize that certain areas and some executives and certain units can only buy so much of it at one time. Effective staff people understand that relationships are for the long term. The second major area under what we might call the power of subordinacy is that you must communicate for results. Communications is a key block for many of us in our organizational living. Executives report that the staff people they like and listen to are people who communicated in a particular way, a results-oriented communication. One of the things that effective staff people do is to play down their competence power. That is, they don't go in spouting the 16 grand wisdoms of the universe. They don't go in enunciating and reminding all present that they are the repository of wisdom and excellence. They don't play the role of the boy or girl wonder child from headquarters. Instead, they tend to be the kind of person who walks in, sits down, pulls out the legal pad, and says, "Please tell me about your problems, and tell me how you think I might be of service." And then, with a series of questions, this person draws out of the client or the customer what's needed. Thus, ask for political advice. Ask them what they can live with. Instead of coming on as the person with all the answers, they come on with a lot of questions. This gives the other person in this human equation a chance to be the expert. Your customers and clients are experts in understanding the realities they have to live with. And while it's important that staff people know what they're talking about too, it's important first to do some listening. It's important to experts to know their areas of ignorance. This listening mode can be likened to being in the confessional. In your staff role, you'll hear in the confessional booth items of wonderment, items that could cause embarrassment, and indications that policies may have been violated. In that confessional, we must play the role of the priest who keeps in absolute confidence the information he hears. The staff loser is the one who runs down to the next office and says, "Guess what I just found out?" The loser is a gossip monger who buries his own and others' careers. You have to play the role of family physician or the family attorney who hears the information and refuses to divulge it. And perhaps in your own judgment, you may not even tell that information to your own boss. The executives in my research report no respect or trust for those who mishandle confidential information. Another suggestion in the communication area is to knock off the verbal razzle-dazzle. Knock off the fancy verbal footwork. Speak simply. Speak truthfully. Speak as you would be spoken to. The reality is that all of us know at least three languages: our particular technical language, the management language, and plain English. Our organizations are really towers of Babel, in which are many foreign tongues. Data processing has its own language. The finance people have their own language. And all specialties have a particular set of buzzwords to operate with. But the effective staff person is the one who learns to be a translator. The effective staff person is the bilingual individual who learns to translate and speak the language of the receiver. I once saw a bright data processing manager come before an executive audience and make an important presentation. He spoke of concatenation, of reiterative loop editing, of gigabytes and bauds. As he did so, I noticed some psychological reactions among his executive audience, what psychologists refer to as negative valence to quotidian variability and cognitive dissonance. In other words, he lost. We all have our fancy language. So what? Can we say it in a way that others can understand? Effective staff communication also provides the audience with sufficient decision data. Data often makes the decision. Management can be correctly programmed. Give them opinions, but be more concerned with giving them facts and data. The unsupported hypothesis shows a staffer who has not done his homework. Finally, executives reported that effective staff people, in their view, learn to solve the right problems. Management needs immediate help, not studies. Whatever studies or research undertakings are necessary for you to fulfill your subordinacy role, don't let them hold up action any longer than absolutely necessary. The executive reality is of deciding now. A better approach is to anticipate the direction of the organization and the direction of your executive. Do your research and studying in advance. Focus on problem prevention and anticipation. Finish ahead of deadlines so that when the immediate help is necessary, you're prepared. A story from military history concerns Napoleon and his chief lieutenant, a man by the name of Cadogan. At the end of a day touring a future battlefield, Cadogan was called into Napoleon's tent. Napoleon said, "Do you know that rise of the hill where we stopped today and where I dropped my glove?" Cadogan said, "Yes." Napoleon responded, "I want the artillery positioned there." Cadogan's famous response, "I have already ordered it." Anticipate your executive. Some staff people want to make a career out of a problem. They get so caught up in the beauty of their specialty that they forget that it's really a next case situation. It's like a long line of people at the meat market. They all have a ticket and they all have an order that needs to be filled. You can't get carried away in isolating the resources, time, and attention of your unit on a single meat order. Solve the problem, get on to the next one, don't get so darn busy that you don't get anything done. Effective staff people, executives reported, were people who seemed to be continually cooking up a whole series of recipes in their kitchens. Effective staff people were also characterized by executives as willing to custom fit solutions to the problem and to the limited budget of the organization. Every decision is a compromise. Every decision means paring down from what you'd like to do to what you can afford to do. Effective staff people are those who don't search for perfection, but search for excellence. Prepare a menu for your executives to select from. Keep in mind that solutions must fit the problem, no more, no less. Avoid staff myopia. Your loyalty is not to your specialty. It is to finding a reasonable solution that management can live with.